This is Ocean Robbins, and I am so excited to welcome you to the final day of the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This has been an extraordinary experience. It's been a milestone event in the future of food for more than 100,000 people. I've been moved to tears by some of the stories I'm hearing about how this message is changing so many people's lives. All over this world, people are fed up with toxic food, sick of being sick, and hungry for change. I'm here with my dad and colleague, John Robbins. For the last 9 days, you've been hearing him interviewing some of the top food experts on the planet. I think part of what's made these interviews so special is that my dad is himself one of the world's most influential food movement leaders. For decades, he's been inspiring millions of people. And I hope in the last 9 days that you may have been touched by his wisdom, his insight, and his love. And now, as we launch into this finale for the Food Revolution Summit, into this conversation between my dad and I, I'm going to turn it over for now to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and welcome everyone who's listening. We are glad to be partners with you in the Food Revolution, in the Food Awakening, in creating a new future for a healthy food system, for each of our bodies, and for the whole Earth community. Ocean, I so thoroughly enjoy working with you in all the ways that I get to. It's been a joy putting on this summit with you, and I've been looking forward to this moment, to this chance to converse with you in depth about the food awakening that's taking place, and to help our listeners take it to the next step. I'm wondering right now, where you'd like to start?
Where would I like to start? Well, I'm thinking right now about the fact that we live in a world where more than a billion of our fellow human beings go to bed hungry at night. Even in the United States, one of the wealthiest countries in the history of the world, the number of hungry kids has been rising. I know that for you, food has long been a source not just of nourishment for our bodies, but an opportunity to take a stand for the kind of world we want to create. When you spoke at the United Nations on the topic of world hunger some years back, you received a standing ovation. You titled one of your many best-selling books, May All Be Fed. For those of us who are disturbed by the presence of hunger on this planet, for those of us who would like to do something about it, what would you have us know?
Well, the first thing is that I'm grateful you're disturbed. I'm glad you're not content or complacent with the amount of hunger that is in the world. And I think it's a crime, really, that we have so much food and so many food resources, but instead of making it a priority to make sure that everyone has healthy food to eat, well, we've had other priorities. And I'm glad that you're not okay with that. I am not either. When I sit down to eat, I'm always aware of the many people in our world who don't have that opportunity. And if they do, they may not have healthy food to eat. And at the same time, I think how wasteful it is that we feed so much of our grain to livestock. It hasn't always been this way. In 1950, barely 10% of the world's grain was then being fed to livestock. But the percentage of our grain that we feed to animals has been going up every year. It's now more than 60%.
If we fed less of our grain to animals and more of it to people, how would that affect hunger on this planet?
Simply reducing U.S. livestock by half would free up enough grain to feed every hungry person in the world five times over. Even reducing 10% would have astounding possibilities. If the people of this country, the United States, were to reduce our beef consumption by 10%, and I do not think that's asking too much, 10%, that would free up enough grain to provide all the caloric needs of 60 million people, which is a telling number. because the World Health Organization tells us that the number of people who will die on Earth this year from hunger and hunger-caused illness is 60 million. We're devoting a staggering amount of our agricultural land and our energy and water to growing livestock feed. We've got about 16 million acres in the United States now growing all of our fruits and vegetables, but we've got 200 million heavily subsidized acres in the country growing genetically engineered corn and soy, most of which we feed to animals. We're not using our land to grow healthy food for people. We're not using it in a sustainable way at all. These genetically engineered crops, corn and soy, require massive uses of herbicides. In fact, that's exactly what they've been genetically engineered to do. This is what they've been designed for, to tolerate unprecedented amounts of herbicide spraying. It's really ironic. We've got a Department of Agriculture that's encouraging us all to eat more fruits and vegetables, but which is spending hundreds of billions of dollars annually to subsidize genetically engineered commodity crops. Almost all of the corn grown in the country is GMO. Most of it goes for animal feed, and the rest is used to make ethanol or to make high fructose corn syrup. About 90% of the soy grown in the country is GMO, and it's almost all used to feed livestock, and the rest to make highly processed food products. As taxpayers, we're heavily subsidizing crops, GMO corn and GMO soy, that are used to produce the factory farm meat and the highly sweetened processed foods we're supposed to be eating less of. And we're doing almost nothing to subsidize the fruits and vegetables we're supposed to be eating more of. If there is a responsibility to spend the public's money in a way that's consistent with the public's health, it should be the other way around. Taxpayers should be subsidizing the foods that are better for us.
I'm struck by the fact that the poor in Africa and Asia are often malnourished and skinny, but the poor in the United States and other industrialized nations are often malnourished and obese.
Yes, and there's a reason for that. It's the direct result of our agricultural policies. By subsidizing livestock feed and high fructose corn syrup and processed food, we've created a food world where per calorie, Twinkies are cheaper than carrots and Doritos are cheaper than apples. The poor in this country are by necessity eating the cheapest calories they can get. Meanwhile, the companies who manufacture these processed foods do so with the explicit intent of promoting ever-increasing consumption of the foods they sell. Their strategy is to add sugar, salt, and fat in order to set in motion an addictive response in the body. Eating junk foods that are high in sugar, salt, and fat has several consequences, one of which is to lead people to crave ever more junk food with ever more sugar, salt, and fat. And there's another piece. Cheap foods like chips and soda and cookies provide loads of cheap and empty calories, but little nutritional value. That's why they're called empty calories. They're empty of nutritive value. When people eat these foods, it leads to an accumulation of excess body fat, even while the body's vital organs are malnourished. The person becomes obese but feels hungry all the time because the human body is not able to function properly on empty calories, and because under such conditions, the brain keeps generating a signal to eat more food. But no matter how much junk food is consumed, the body does not get the nutrition it needs to thrive. It seems counterintuitive that obese people would feel hungry all the time, but they often do. People who are experiencing serious financial stress will eat the cheapest calories they can find, and as a result of our perverse system of subsidies, a system that makes Oreos cheaper than oranges, they end up eating foods that have been manufactured to have addictive qualities. The empty calories cause fat to accumulate, but don't nourish the body, so the brain continues to signal the need for more food. As the obese person gets heavier, their internal organs are literally starving for the nutrients they need. The result is obese people who are slowly dying from malnutrition.
People who are overweight and obese are often very judgmental of themselves and often seen as greedy or gluttonous, when in fact they may be to some degree victims of the biggest drug pushers of our times, the food companies who are profiting from and generating of an epidemic of addiction. I find this especially painful with obese kids who have no capacity to understand the forces that are addicting them to unhealthy foods. It's really sad to see how many kids today are already caught in the cycle of obesity and addiction.
One of my central goals in creating the Food Revolution Summit is to help change this. I think we should be asking how we can make healthy food more affordable. I think we should be changing our subsidies so that we are supporting everyone in eating healthily. It's painful for me to see healthy food available, but only to the wealthy. This is something we desperately need to change. I'd like to see healthy food be considered a basic human right. Ocean, I've always known you to be someone who has cared deeply about the inequities in the world and who has wanted a healthy future that includes everybody. You've organized and you've co-facilitated extremely diverse leadership gatherings in Selma, Alabama, in the Middle East, and in American inner cities. You've received a lot of awards for your work, and in fact, you and your wife, my daughter in love, Michelle, were honored a few years ago as the couple of the movement at the annual Selma Bridge Crossing Jubilee. This award is given every year to civil rights movement heroes, and I believe you were the first white couple ever to receive it. The first couple of any race to receive it had, in fact, been Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King. Ocean, healthy food is sometimes viewed as a kind of elitist luxury. But for you, I know it's deeply connected to your passion for social justice.
It's true.
Can you tell our listeners why?
A lot of people think that organic, non-GMO, sustainable, healthy food is for the rich, but that the beggars can't be choosers and healthy food is just too expensive for most people. In the long term, of course, healthy food and a healthy life make huge economic sense. Last time I checked, cancer was pretty expensive. So were heart disease and diabetes. A diet based around staples like brown rice and beans and lentils and cabbage can actually be remarkably affordable. But for a lot of people who are struggling to survive, who are struggling to put any food on the table at all, the cheapest and certainly the most accessible calories are often highly processed foods that are loaded with fat, sugar, salt, and chemicals. In West Oakland, California, there are 37 liquor stores, and there's not one full-service grocery store. Not surprisingly, rates of obesity and chronic illness in West Oakland are, like in many low-income communities, devastatingly high. The life expectancy in Harlem is lower than in Bangladesh, and the life expectancy on Pine Ridge Reservation is under 50 years. The costs of sickness in our low-income communities are destroying lives. They're dragging down economic activity, and they're adding a massive burden to our entire medical system as well as to our social safety net. Meanwhile, the people most impacted by the neurotoxic pesticides that we routinely spray on our agricultural fields are the people who work in them. It's no accident that life expectancy among migrant farm workers in the U.S. today is under 49 years. Many of these people are working 12 hours a day with low pay and no health insurance. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers recently won a penny-a-pound raise from Walmart, and that was a huge victory. But I want to put it in perspective. Tomato pickers are now earning a whopping $20,000 a year for extremely long hours of hard labor. That's a lot better than the $11,000 a year they were trying to survive on before. But we've obviously got a long ways to go before we're going to have a truly fair and just food system. Meanwhile, in India, farmers have been promised huge profits by Monsanto if they switch over to growing Monsanto's GMO crops. When those profits fail to materialize, as they often do, many of these farmers are losing their farms and they're going bankrupt. It's hard to comprehend the sheer scale of the human cost of this tragedy. More than 250,000 farmers in India have committed suicide, usually by drinking pesticides, in just the last 20 years. Given these realities, I think it's fair to say that food may be one of the paramount social justice issues of our times. When you choose to take a stand for healthy, sustainable, local, humane, fair trade food, you are making a huge difference in the world. You're making a difference for the well-being and the lives of people you will never meet, but who are nevertheless profoundly impacted by what you do. When you buy organic, you are sparing your body exposure to pesticide residues, and you're also sparing farm workers far greater exposure to these poisons. Those of us who have access to this information and the opportunity to take action on it are profoundly privileged. And with that privilege comes, I think, a kind of responsibility. In fact, I think that any kind of wealth or fame or power brings with it responsibility. But we see in the world today the reality of how often wealth and fame are being used to consolidate more wealth and fame. Now, you, on the other hand, are an exception to this. You were born into a very wealthy and famous family. Your dad, as most of our listeners probably know, was the founder and the owner of Baskin-Robbins, and you chose to take a very different path. Sometimes that path has been informed by pain as well as by vision. I know that at one point in your journey, you experienced a deep sense of despair that actually helped propel you forward on your path. I'm wondering, would you be willing to tell us what happened?
Well, this is the side of my story I haven't spoken about very much publicly, but as you know, Ocean, I had polio as a child and was in a wheelchair for a while. And even when the feeling and movement returned to my legs, it did so only to some degree, and more so in one leg than the other. When I was 21, my left leg was 3 inches shorter than my right and weak. I could not put much weight on it. And doctors had told me, well, your growing years are over. You're just going to have to live with this. But I was determined not to listen to that projection about my future. And I was determined to see if there might be another possibility for me. And when I did walk away from Baskin-Robbins and my father's expectations for my life, I began to live very differently, and I began to do yoga every day and meditate every day and do very deep therapy to investigate the assumptions and beliefs and fears that I had inherited from my family of origin and from our culture as a whole, and began to eat very, very differently than I had been accustomed to eating in my family of origin. And my leg grew, and I began to walk better and run, and eventually became, as you know, a marathon runner and a triathlete and athletic in many ways. But along the way, it was very rugged at times, and I remember once being in great despair about whether I was ever going to be able to amount to anything. I had chosen at that point to walk away from Baskin-Robbins and the financial security that it represented, but I didn't know what I was going to do with my life, and I didn't know how I was going to make a living, and I didn't know how I was going to manage. And I remember at one point really getting sick, and sick at heart and sick in the body, and I didn't know where to turn. And I wasn't going back to my parents. That was clear. So I actually went to my higher power, and I said, I don't know why this suffering has been given to me, but I want to be worthy of it. I want to find a way somehow to transform it into life purpose and passion and commitment. And I kind of negotiated, I guess, with God, and I said, if you give me health, if you let me find my way to health, I will use it on behalf of the health of others. I really made that vow and that commitment very deeply. And I really do believe that pain can carry the seeds or the potential for breakthrough, that suffering can be a birthplace for compassion, that illness itself can give rise to a commitment to health. And that's what happened for me. And I eventually found myself writing books on nutrition and health and finding myself living with a capacity for aliveness and engagement and connection with other people that was so much greater than anything I had dreamed of it being. And my life has been a blessing in many ways to experience, and that the opportunity to give the gifts that have come through me has been a great joy. And I've wondered often, Ocean, what it's been like for you growing up in such an unusual family.
Well, I do have a kind of unusual family. You know, I was born to parents that were doing yoga and practicing meditation for several hours a day, growing most of their own food, and who named their kid Ocean. I grew up in a family where around the dinner table we'd talk about things like the state of the world, factory farms, the nuclear arms race, and what we could do to build more love and more beauty and more opportunity on this planet. We also talked about our feelings and our dreams. So one of the interesting dynamics for me was knowing that all of this grew out of the history of your childhood. Because you grew up in a very different family than the one that I grew up in. You grew up in a family that was quite intent on selling a lot of ice cream. Your father made and sold more ice cream than any human being who's probably ever lived on this planet. And as a kid, you may have eaten more ice cream than any kid who's ever lived on this planet. And you also grew up in a family where children were to be seen and not heard, where you were expected to follow orders and do as you were told. It was a very hierarchical kind of a system. You were trained to take your place as a man in that system, and indeed to become a leader in that system. That's what was expected of you. Whereas I grew up with you quoting Thoreau telling me that it was a beautiful thing to march to the beat of your own drummer. So I feel very grateful for that. I also want to say that I feel really grateful for growing up with a foundation of eating really healthy food. I was not exposed to junk food in my early years really at all. And it showed. When I was 10, I ran my first marathon. I was setting school records in my elementary school for push-ups and pull-ups. And still to this day, at 40 years old, I have more energy than I know what to do with. I feel really grateful for that. And I also know that within our family, we've had quite a journey.
Yes, we certainly have. How would you describe our journey? What has it been like from your point of view?
As you know, my grandfather, your dad, ate the standard American diet plus an extra bonus double scoop of ice cream on top. When he was 72, having already decades earlier lost his own brother-in-law and business partner Burt Baskin to a heart attack, he himself was facing some pretty severe health challenges. He had severe diabetes. He had serious heart disease. He was told by his doctors that he likely didn't have long to live. Then, remarkably enough, his physician handed him a copy of your book, Diet for a New America. I've often reflected on that moment and wondered what it would be like to have a videotape of the look on his face when his doctor handed him your book. Now, the amazing thing, as you well know, is that he did eventually read your book, and he did make changes, and he got the results that are fairly predictable. He lost about 30 pounds. He got off all of his diabetes medications. He got off the medications he was taking for high blood pressure. He became able to walk several miles a day, and his golf game improved by 7 strokes. He wound up having another 15 or more healthy, vibrant years after that. I will never forget him telling us when he was nearing the end of his life, "Thank God some of us have lived long enough to learn a few new things." You know, I admire his courage and his tenacity and his willingness to question the standard American diet, of which he had been a major proponent, and to make the changes that would save his life. I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful for the family journey that enabled him to make those changes, that enabled you to make the radical changes you did, and that helped propel me in the work that I do. Because in our own family journey, we've seen where the standard American diet goes. We've seen what happened to your uncle, Burt Baskin. We've seen where my grandpa was headed. We've seen where you were headed. And we've also seen what can happen when we make a change. And I love the fact that the work you started and the work we're now doing together is helping millions of people to make those kinds of changes. We know what it's like to have a lot of momentum in the other direction. We know what it's like to change course. We know what happens when we can change course. And rooted deeply in medical science and what the experts are discovering, we know that it is possible to radically change your health and life outcome, not just to increase quantity of life, not just to extend years, but to increase health, vitality, joy, fulfillment, pleasure, aliveness. And ultimately, that's the point, I think. And I love the fact we're helping so many people to thrive.
Well, I do too, and I consider it a privilege, actually. And I'm remembering when I worked for my dad at Baskin-Robbins before I left, the amount of sugar that the company would purchase and put into its products was staggering. And when I left and changed the way I lived, I stopped eating sugar at all. And, of course, in the household you grew up in, there was none. But I remember when you were 6 or 7 years old and you would go to your friends' birthday parties and to other social events at their houses. Of course, there was served at those festivities ice cream and birthday cakes. How was that for you?
Growing up, when I was a kid, of course, I started off not eating sugar, added sugar at all. And then when I was in school and my friends were having their birthday parties, you know, I wanted to join them. And I remember seeing all those cakes, which I had never been exposed to before, and a part of me wanted to know what that was like. But I also knew that it wasn't good for me. So I remember having this kind of quandary. I wanted to belong. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to feel connected to my friends. They were all very excited about the cake. I mean, it was like the centerpiece of the party was the cake and the candles. But I kind of had mixed feelings about it. I remember feeling like I was an undercover investigator because I wanted to see what would happen when the kids ate the cake. How did it affect them? And I remember having this remarkable experience that before the cake came out, the kids were getting along, playing happily, having a lot of fun. And then after the cake, within a short period of time, there'd be fights erupting, there'd be people crying, there'd be a lot of upset. And I thought to myself, is it possible that the cake is contributing to that? And then I remember coming to you once when I had decided to give cake a try myself. I had eaten some, and I knew that it was kind of not something we did in our family, but I decided to give it a try, and I came to you a few days later. I was actually a little nervous about it. And I told you that I had eaten some cake at a birthday party. Now, this may not sound like a major cardinal sin, but in our family, that was kind of a big step, and I was a little nervous about how you'd respond, actually. Do you remember what you said?
I do. I do, Ocean. And I remember that you had eaten ice cream as well. And I think it may have been for the first time. But I said, thank you for telling me. I was so glad that we had the connection and the trust that you could tell me. And I thought it was far more important, and I think I told you, it's far more important to me that the lines of communication between us be open and authentic and real than that you don't eat sugar or follow some rule or, you know, you'll find your own way. You'll find your truth and your health and your path. But I want to be a partner with you and your father in an age-appropriate way along that path so that I can be a support for you in individuating and differentiating and being true to who you are, and that you could share with me something that you thought I might disapprove of and had the courage to do that. That filled me with more joy than I would have had had you not eaten the ice cream and cake.
I think that's amazing. And I don't know how many parents could say that, but I think it's a beautiful thing that you valued honesty and you valued the integrity of our relationship more than you valued trying to be perfect or to do everything right. I felt like you were holding a space for me at that time to be conscious, to be connected to you, and to be the author of my own destiny all at the same time. Honestly, I think part of the reason that so many people have felt drawn to your leadership in the food movement has actually been because people can feel that you aren't judging them. You're not opening up their fridge and criticizing them. You are actually interested in helping people, helping all of us, really, to be in integrity as best we can with our own conscience. I think people feel invited by your work into greater congruency between their values and their actions instead of judged or criticized into submission with some kind of dogmatic set of rules. And I think that's why, over the last 27 years, you've become an inspiration to so many millions of people. And I want to ask you about that. You've written 10 books that have sold 3 million copies and been translated into more than 30 languages. You've probably given thousands of talks and reached maybe more than a million people in live in-person presentations. Your work, as we've heard throughout this summit, has been a catalytic inspiration for probably a majority of the people you've interviewed. And now in this summit, you stepped back to be the interviewer. You've played kind of a background role, helping each of our speakers to shine in their voice and their genius and their message. Now, there aren't a lot of people I know who are capable of being a charismatic leader and who are also able to be so gracious and skillful in more of a background kind of a role. You've offered thoughtful, skillful questions. You've elicited the genius in so many other people. And I'm curious, what's it been like for you to play this kind of a background role?
Thank you, Ocean, for your generous words. To answer your question, I've totally loved playing what you're calling a background role. I've totally loved it. You know, it's always a pleasure to help other people to shine and bring forth their gifts. But in this case, it's been really special because, I mean, it's been a total joy because we've been blessed with an absolute all-star team of speakers. I felt it to be a total privilege to have this opportunity to engage in deep conversations with people I greatly admire. I've loved having the opportunity to collaborate with such dedicated and informed and passionate people. These are not just people I personally think so highly of. They're also people whose thoughts and actions are literally changing our food world. As I've interviewed them, I've gotten to listen to their wisdom. I've gotten to receive their insights and perspectives. And I have found that to be greatly enriching. And also, I think the diversity of their backgrounds and areas of expertise, the diversity of their personalities and communication styles, has helped to create a vibrant summit.
We've been getting a lot of questions on Facebook and over email about the differing points of view of our various speakers. Some people seem confused or disturbed that everyone isn't in agreement about everything.
I know. I think Jonathan Safran Foer, one of our speakers, spoke to this when he asked the question, how can we have this conversation in a way that reminds people that these are things that we all care about, instead of in ways that are divisive and make people feel aggressive or defensive? My intention has been to interview speakers who bring a spirit of inclusiveness, a spirit of respect and support, rather than criticism, into these conversations, especially when discussing topics that can be polarizing. I think it's important to remember that there are many fundamental agreements among our speakers.
What specifically do you think all of our speakers agree on?
I'm thinking of Michael Pollan's simple formula: eat food, mostly plants, not too much. I think all of our speakers would agree with that. And by eat food, we mean real food, actual food, not the processed and refined and manufactured food-like things that are full of chemicals and full of added sugars and salts and fats. I think we all agree there. And I think we all agree, too, that organic is great, that the marketing of junk food to kids should be banned, and that GMOs, at the very least, should be labeled. We agree on a lot. But it is true that there are some areas of disagreement among our speakers.
The issue about whether meat should be included in a healthy diet can be extremely contentious.
Michael Pollan's famous formula says, eat mostly plants. Some of our speakers think that 100% or something pretty close to that would be the ideal amount of plant foods. They use the word vegan. I prefer the word plant strong because I want to emphasize two things. I want to emphasize the strength that comes from plants, and I want to make room for those who eat mostly plants but want some high-quality animal food in their diets. I know this is a topic which can become highly polarized, which is why I appreciate something that Wayne Pacelli, one of our speakers, said. He spoke of the three R's: refine, reduce, and replace. If you're going to eat animal products, refine them. That means get better quality. If you're going to eat beef, get grass-fed without antibiotics or hormones. If you're going to eat eggs, get them from hens who are well-treated. And reduce. Eat less of them. We have become accustomed to levels of meat consumption in this culture that are extravagant, that are utterly unsustainable, and that are a driving force behind climate change, behind species extinction, behind soil erosion and deforestation and world hunger and so many other of our most serious problems today. So refine and reduce and replace. When you take meat off your plate, replace it with something healthy and good. Eat more greens. Eat more vegetables of all kinds. Eat more real food.
Some people strongly identify as vegans or vegetarians or flexitarians. Some don't, and they don't always get along.
Essentially, when you come down to it, I don't care whether you call yourself a vegan, a vegetarian, a flexitarian, or an asparagus. Just eat healthy, whole foods, eat a plant-strong diet, and live with respect for yourself and for others. And remember the third line in Michael Pollan's formula, not too much. We need to enjoy our food thoroughly, so thoroughly that we don't have to overeat to feel satisfied. We need, I think, to eat less and laugh more. We need to eat less and breathe more. We need to eat less and love more.
How do you feel about the fact that there are areas of disagreement among our speakers?
I actually think it's a good thing that there are areas of disagreement among our speakers. I would worry if we all agreed about everything. That would scare me, because I'm no fan of groupthink. This isn't about creating a cult where everyone thinks alike. I think it's healthy to air the different points of view and not insist on total agreement on every point. We are each unique individuals. Each of us has our own biochemical individuality to honor. And each of us is responsible for our healing path and the fulfillment of our life purpose.
What's your goal for our work together?
My goal is for the Food Revolution Network and the Food Revolution Summits to provide information, inspiration, and motivation. My goal is not to provide final answers to every question, but to ignite a dialogue that enables the food revolution to grow and evokes in each of us an ability to live with our questions in a deeper and more informed and caring way. I would rather we respect our differences than try to reconcile every one of them. A certain amount of diversity is healthy. It provides resilience and sparks further learning. I don't want to see us become dogmatic and rigid, and I don't want to see us playing nutritional one-upmanship games. I do want to see us being curious. I want to see us respecting ourselves and each other. I want to see us appreciating our differences as we undertake this beautiful journey of learning and healing we call the human experience. It's been said that the teacher, who is indeed wise, does not bid you to enter the house of his or her wisdom, but rather leads you to the threshold of your own.
I appreciate that about you, that you've always wanted me to be real, to find and live my authentic truth, whether or not it's agreed entirely with your own. Sometimes people ask me if I feel like I'm walking in your shadow, and I say no. I feel like I'm standing in your light. I feel like my life and my path are illumined and supported and affirmed in countless ways by your example, by your love, by your support, and by your partnership. It's a pretty unusual thing, I think, for a father and son to be working together with the degree of alignment that we have and the degree of freedom that I feel we're each committed to nurturing. Freedom of thought, creativity, innovation, and adventure. I remember vividly when I was a kid and my grandparents invited me to come visit them. I went down by myself. I think I was about 12 at the time. And my grandpa said to me, he hadn't yet read Diet for New America, And he was still smarting, I think, from the fact that you'd walked away from his company. And I remember him sitting me down. They took me out on a big shopping spree, and they bought me a ton of stuff, all kinds of clothes and toys and things. And then he sat me down, and he said, "We just want you to know that not every child goes on the same path as their parents. Your dad didn't follow the same path that we had in mind for him. And you might someday decide that you don't want to follow the same path that, you know, your parents would have in mind for you. And we want you to know that if ever you get tired of your parents' ways of thinking and doing things and you kind of want to go another way, we want you to know that there's plenty of money and support over here to help you out if ever you want to do things differently from their way." I remember sitting there hearing him, and at that time I was a big fan of the Star Wars movies. I felt like I was listening to Darth Vader saying, "Luke, come to the dark side." And, I, you know, there was this part of me that was like, wow, you really want me to, like, you know, rebel against my dad and follow you. And I was struck by that. And then I thought, but here's the difference. You know, my dad isn't trying to push me on a path. He's actually trying to help me be who I want to be and whom I'm here to be and to follow my own destiny.
I'm grateful that you've experienced my fathering the way that you have. Being a parent is never easy. You have to help your children to learn how to get along in the world as it is. But I've always felt that it's no measure of sanity to be well-adjusted to an insane society. So I've always wanted to support your authorship of your own life.
And you have, beautifully. And one of the things I love about being CEO of the Food Revolution Network is that I'm building on the work that you've been doing for the last 27 years. And I'm taking advantage of modern technology and new ways of learning and doing and engaging. I love that we're making this work accessible to so many people. I mean, there we were 3 years ago, looking at the fact that your books had sold 3 million copies and you had no online presence and no Facebook page. I don't even know if you knew what Facebook was, to be perfectly frank. And there was this feeling I had at that time, like, wow, we can do a lot better. If we really want to change the world, which we obviously do, we're going to have to do a lot better because the times are too urgent. We've got to find ways to keep sourcing and bringing this message out. I also love that this is continuing on even to the next generation. You know, I have 13-year-old twins, as you know very well, River and Bodie. And we all live, of course, on the same land in a couple different houses. And I am so grateful that my sons, who have special needs as well as special gifts, who are my greatest teachers in ways that are both humbling as well as inspiring, that they are such big partners in the food revolution. They've been really passionate throughout this summit. They've been listening to lots of the interviews and talking about them constantly. It really warms my heart. My son River said to me recently, just as he was going to sleep, I was sitting next to him on his bed, and he said, "I'm so proud of you." And I said, "Why, River?" And he said, "Because you're making people's lives better, and you're making the world better, and that makes me really happy." And I thought, you know, I'm so glad that my son gets to have an experience that I also had growing up, of having a father that he appreciates.
River also played an important strategic role in our work recently, didn't he?
Well, yeah, actually, River kind of tipped me off to one of our strategies in the food revolution. We had some setbacks in the food movement in the last couple of years when voters got to vote in the states of California and Washington on the labeling of genetically engineered foods. And Monsanto and the junk food industry teamed up and spent somewhere on the order of $60 million in these massive campaigns misleading voters, outright lying about the issues. And in each case, the voters ended up not passing the initiative by a 51-49% margin. This despite the fact that 94% of the American public supports GMO labeling, despite the fact that we have GMO labeling in 64 countries around the world. So what happened was that my son River was with me in the store one day. We were doing some shopping. I was hot. My blood sugar was low. I was thirsty. And there were a bunch of Odwalla drinks, this kind of smoothie beverage. And I picked one up, and I was about to open it right then and there in the store and start drinking it. And my son River looks at me, and he says, "Odwalla is owned by Coke." I don't know where he picked that up, but he knew it. And I said, "Yeah." And I hadn't opened it quite yet. And he says, "Put that back." I said, "Why, River?" He said, "Because you don't want to give your money to Coke, do you?" And I looked at him, and I was like, wow, my son's speaking with a lot of authority here. And I realized I couldn't, in good conscience, drink that Adwala right then and there and tell him that, yeah, I was fine giving my money to Coke. So I put that drink back. And then a short time later, I was thinking, what can we do to make some of these companies pay a price for spending millions of dollars fighting GMO labeling? And I saw that Pepsi and Coke and a couple other companies had literally spent millions of dollars fighting it, and that they owned some of the cherished natural brands that the natural foods consumers are supporting every day. And I realized that just like I was about to drink that Adwala, which somehow I thought was healthy and good compared to Coke, I didn't want to be supporting the fight against labeling. I didn't want to be supporting the corporate practices of what Coca-Cola was doing. And I realized that the natural foods consumers movement might not drink a lot of Coke, so a boycott of Coke might not mean a whole lot, but we do drink a lot of Honest Tea, Adwala, Zico Coconut Water, Dasani, maybe even vitamin water, and all of these products are owned by Coca-Cola. So, actually inspired in part by my son's example, we ended up in the Food Revolution Network taking on a Coke boycott campaign, which is based at CokeBoycott.com. And we launched this initiative to publicize the fact that all of these natural brands are owned by Coca-Cola and to call on Coca-Cola to stop fighting labeling of GMOs and to say we're going to call for a boycott of these brands until Coke does that. Well, we've had more than 250,000 people join in this campaign. The Center for Food Safety has gotten on board as well. And we're not stopping until Coca-Cola stops fighting the right to know.
Well, that's a marvelous campaign, and I'm glad to be part of it with you, and I know that Little River had played an instrumental part in it. Can you describe for our listeners some of the other Food Revolution Network's projects and particularly what they mean to you?
Well, I'd love to. The food world is changing fast, and we are constantly learning more. Science is learning more, and we need access to the information about what's really going on. A problem is that there is so much disinformation out there. There are a lot of heavily funded interests that want to confuse us and distract us and to keep us buying their products. We need up-to-date, credible information to help us ground our choices and our communications with the people in our lives. To help share the latest breaking news, we email action and education updates to our members. We also have a blog at foodrevolution.org. where we published over 70 articles and dozens of videos. We have an Ask John section where people can actually ask you questions and you can answer them. We've got a Facebook page where we post several times a day with inspiring quotes as well as breaking news about what's really going on in the food world. And we take on campaigns on urgent issues like the currently active Coke boycott campaign. We also are sponsoring online courses. And this is where I really want to help people to get into the nitty-gritty of how do you do it? Now, how do you practice this message? How do you put it into action? So this is where we're going to be helping people step-by-step to put it into delicious action in their lives and become empowered to have our kitchens become healthy and thriving and ultimately a beacon of health and thriving for our loved ones and our families and our communities. We're also planning future summits, and I'm sure there's more to come. There's just so much work that needs to be done. You know, we're up against some pretty powerful forces that are heavily funded. This month's National Geographic has a cover story titled The Food Revolution. But it's not the food revolution that you're talking about, that you were talking about when you wrote the book The Food Revolution 14 years ago. They're talking about something very different, I'm sorry to say.
I've read the article in the National Geographic, and I'm, like you, I'm not happy with it. It reads to me like it was approved by Monsanto. And as you say, that is not the food revolution I've been talking about. We do need a food revolution, though, because whenever we eat, we make a choice. Whenever we choose a food, we either improve the world or we make it less. We either sustain the conditions that are conducive to life or we worsen and harm them. We need a food revolution because it is an act of courage and love to prepare healthy food for ourselves and for others, and to speak out and to educate people. We need a food revolution for so many, many reasons. Because every year in this country we throw away 100 billion pounds of food, which means we're feeding our landfills as much as we're feeding our people. Why is all this food being thrown away and not being given to those who need it? Why are we wasting so much food and not making sure that everyone has enough to eat? We need a food revolution because we're feeding our landfills and our livestock instead of feeding healthy food to our people. We need a food revolution because 65 years ago, people in the United States spent 22% of our disposable personal income on food and 5% on health care. And now, we spend 9% of our disposable personal income on food and 18% on health care. The percentage we spend on food today is less than half of what it was in 1950. But the percentage we spend on what we call health care, but which we really should call disease management, has nearly quadrupled. We need a food revolution because our cheap food is making us fat and sick and bankrupting us. We need a food revolution because Western food is taking over the world. You know, traditional cultural cuisines are enriched. They're even defined by their use of herbs and spices. In Indian food, it's curries and turmeric and cardamom and coriander. In Mexican food, it's chilies and cumin, garlic and oregano. In Italian food, parsley and sage, basil and thyme. In French food, it's marjoram and tarragon and savory. In every case, the herbs and spices not only add fascination and intrigue to the flavors of the foods, they also define the culture and they have health benefits. But with industrial processed food, with what has come to be known worldwide as American food, instead of herbs and spices to add culinary interest, we've added huge amounts of sugar and fat and salt. These overpower our taste buds and mask the lack of flavor of industrial food. And rather than supporting health, they lead to heart disease, obesity, diabetes, and all the other Western diseases that plague us today and that we are exporting worldwide along with our foods. We need a food revolution because the richness of our relationship to food has been hijacked by the corporate manipulation of our taste buds. I hear people say, I want to eat what I like. That's my right. That's my freedom. True, but what people like has been determined by the food industry. They have sought control over our taste buds, and to a remarkable extent, they have achieved that control. People don't naturally like what will make them sick and fat. People want to be healthy. They want to feel vibrant. But the corporate food industry has added so much salt, so much sugar, and so much fat to the foods they sell us that they've gotten most of us hooked. Now, many of us feel deprived if we aren't eating foods that undermine our health. We need a food revolution so we can take back our taste buds, so we can take back our mouths and our tongues. We need a food revolution so we can experience eating not as an exercise in addiction, but as a way of making love with life, a way of being intimate with the world, a way of affirming the values and the joys we hold most dear.
You express it so beautifully. And what I find also beautiful is that so many people are living it. We're actually in a very exciting time. I think that the norms of a toxic food culture are fast losing their appeal, and people are really hungry for change. We've seen in the last 15 years a fourfold increase in sales of organic foods. We now have polls in the United States showing that more than 90% of the American public thinks that animals raised for food on farms deserve to be free from cruelty. 9 U.S. states have joined the entire European Union in banning gestational crates for pigs. Australia's 2 largest supermarket chains and now the state of California are banning eggs from chickens raised in cages. We've got a long way to go, but we are seeing progress in many ways. Non-GMO certified foods have gone from being nothing to a $5 billion industry in the last 3 years. The number of farmers markets, community-supported agriculture programs are expanding rapidly. After 60 years of less and less farms in the United States every year, that trend in the last 3 years has reversed. We're now seeing more farms, more small-scale community gardens. The capital of community gardens in the United States is Detroit, a city that has been hit by massive economic instability and pain. But one of these little seeds of hope and resilience in that community is community gardens, where people are actually putting some of the vacant lots to work to grow food for communities that are struggling to survive. There is a food movement growing and building. It's building in political power. It's building in economic power. We now have 30 states where there's efforts to label GMOs in the U.S. We have many countries around the world that are not just labeling GMOs, but that are now starting to ban them. The country of Mexico just recently banned the growing of genetically modified corn. Many countries throughout Europe ban the growing of GMO corn. They won't even import it, except in some cases to feed to livestock. And in some countries, they won't even do that. We're seeing a radical change taking place in the food movement and in the power that's coming out of the food movement. And it's interesting because this is showing up often in everyday, very simple choices. You know, people go shopping and where they shop and what they choose to buy when they shop, what they choose to feed their families. It's a whole lot of little drops in the bucket. But when you add it up, it can actually become more than a bucket. It can start to become the tide of history turning. So I'm excited by the times that we're in. I think this is a galvanizing movement and a galvanizing time to be a part of this movement.
I'm remembering a few minutes ago we spoke about you're going to a birthday party when you were 7 or 8 years old. And even then, already, you were exploring for yourself and thinking for yourself and coming to terms with the toxic food culture and how you were going to relate to it. And the activist in you was already starting to emerge in its young way at that time. And I see you, Ocean, as a leader now. And in your own right, utterly, it is a joy to work with you. It is a joy to be your father, and it is a joy to be your student.
Well, thank you. I'm really touched by that. And I want to turn it around to the community of people that are part of this summit and that are part of this movement to say that there's kind of a myth in our times, I think, that there are experts and then there's everybody else. And while expertise is precious and wonderful and leadership is an incredibly necessary quality, I want to say that it is possible for any of us to achieve a level of expertise and to step into leadership. And in fact, in these times, I think that it is becoming something of a moral necessity that we find our voice, that we find our calling, that we speak out and get engaged. Because passivity, because blind acquiescence to the status quo, is actually the thief of our own destiny. And it may be the thief of the future of healthy, thriving life on this planet. We can't afford to go down the ready-made, prepackaged road that is so easily disseminated for us. We have to find new ways of living, new ways of working, new ways of being in this world. We have to take leadership in our own lives. When we do that, we become capable of something powerful. We become bigger. We become more alive. We become more vital. We take our place in some way in the vital work of our time.
Ocean, what can you say to people who feel that their lives are insignificant and that the problems are so huge that what they do doesn't matter?
There's an old fable about a grumpy old man who's walking along the beach one day. There was a huge storm the night before, and it had washed thousands of starfish up on the beach. And now all these starfish are lying in the sand, helpless, unable to get back in the water, dying. The grumpy old man is irritated because these starfish are getting in his way as he walks along the beach. Ahead of him, he sees a little girl who's running from the sand to the water, back to the sand and back to the water, and he's curious what she might be doing. He walks over to her and he says, "Excuse me, little girl, what do you think you're doing?" She picks up a starfish and runs to the ocean where she places it gently in the water. And she says, I'm putting the starfish back in the water. They'll die if I don't. The grumpy old man frowns and says, well, there are thousands of starfish up and down this beach for miles. There is no way you could possibly save them all. What you're doing does not make one bit of difference. But the little girl, she picks up another starfish and she takes it down to the water. Then she looks at the man and she smiles and she says, it mattered to that one, because that one is going to live. Then she picks up another one and says, it matters to this one, too. Well, the grumpy old man looks at her and he scratches his head for a few seconds. And then he realizes that the little girl has a point. So he picks up a starfish and decides to take it to the water. Before long, he and the little girl are both picking up starfish and returning them to the water. Because after all, it matters to every one of them. You know, I don't know if we're going to be able to transform our food systems and have a dominant norm of health and vitality for all beings on this planet in my lifetime. But I do know that it mattered to that one. It mattered to a lot of that one. And I'm committed to doing everything I can with this precious life that I'm blessed to have to leverage the privilege, the resources, the opportunities, the blessings, even the wounds and pains and struggles of my life to somehow use them on behalf of what I love. And on behalf of the well-being of this planet. And that is the sacred, precious, beautiful, magical honor that I feel called to and that I feel so many people are called to in these times. And I thank you for being a beacon of courage and inspiration down through the decades and throughout my entire life. And I thank you for your partnership as well as your leadership as we together are doing the work that needs to be done.
Well, Ocean, so beautifully said, and I thank you for your partnership and your leadership. And may I close with these words. May all be fed. May all be healed. May all be loved.
May all be fed. May all be healed. May all be loved. You've been listening to John and Ocean Robbins. In the final segment of the Food Revolution Summit, we thank you for your partnership and for your leadership. It has been a pleasure to join you in these last 9 days, and it will be a pleasure to work with you in the days and years to come for a more healthy, a more beautiful, a more thriving planet and food future for all of life. Thank you so much.